Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Apple did it again. Last week, the tech giant unveiled three bigger and pricier smartphones and a model of watch that includes a fall detector. Here's a description from Apple COO Jeff Williams at the Cupertino, California headquarters.
With a new accelerometer and gyroscope, the watch analyzes wrist trajectory and impact acceleration to determine when a fall occurs. And after detecting a fall, Series 4 delivers an alert. And from that alert, you can initiate an emergency call. However, if the watch senses you are mobile for 1 minute, it will start the call automatically. And it also sends a message with your locations to your emergency contacts using the SOS feature that is already built into Apple Watch.
Joining us by phone is CNET Executive Editor Ian Scher. Welcome back, Ian.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. So are we talking about baby boomers and their parents here now or what? I mean, it looks like, this, you know, is this a gift you'll buy your elderly parent?
There are actually people I've spoken to who are thinking about that. I mean, what's interesting is that Apple is continually trying to eat up a bunch of different markets when they expand the features of all of their devices, right? They're going after the camera market with the iPhone. And in this case, in some way, they seem to be going after the first alert market with the watch. And look, the first alerts, and they're kind of those sensors that elderly people wear, they do have a monthly cost and they add up. And some people are saying, well, wait a minute. I want something that I can easily track my parents with anyway. And if this watch is going to detect when they fall, or it has a heart rate sensor that's going to notice if they have a heart problem of some sort, then maybe this thing is worth it. And that's why suddenly you're starting to hear those kind of things come out.
It's smart marketing.
You know, it is smart marketing for sure, and that's something we can always attribute to Apple. But one of the things is that, look, we haven't tested all these features at CNET yet. We are working on that. But generally speaking, the health features that have been a part of the Apple Watch since it first came out some 3 years ago have been what they promised to be, right? The heart rate sensor was one of the best that we had ever tried. The step counter that's built into it, which seems pretty normal these days, but that was also one of the best we'd ever tried. So it's not like Apple is just marketing something that's standard fare. They are continually putting out a device that's one of the leading of the industry.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the new Apple products out on the market or coming to the market. My guest is executive editor at CNET, Ian Scher. If you have a question or comment about the new iPhones, the new Apple Watch, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Okay, so is the fall detector the only big feature or big new feature for the Apple Watch?
The other thing, they had this ECG monitor or EKG monitor, which is actually built into the little crown, the circular thing at the top of the watch. This is the only time that apparently a consumer device has ever had this. And it was blessed by the FDA. The Apple actually had to go to them and get approval to sell this device for that. But, you may have remembered that Apple had a partnership with Stanford University to do a heart rate survey, and they actually had an app you could download for your watch that would send them anonymous data about you and about your heart rate as you were using it. And apparently they used some of that data to help them with this sensor. So, they're doing that type of stuff. And then, of course, there's the other parts about it that they continually improve. For example, that the cellular versions that work without your phone, they say, is much better. Mm-hmm. And they are continually turning it into a device that could last on its own without a phone, which is rather amazing when you consider that we've lived with phones in our pockets forever. Now they want to make these devices work independently as well.
Which is rather amazing considering they just rolled out three really, really expensive phones.
Yes, that's the other really fascinating thing going on here, right?
Yeah.
The Apple iPhone has gotten so much more expensive in the past couple of years. It used to be you paid $650 for a high-end phone. Now the entire industry has followed Apple's lead. Last year, Apple started with a $999 iPhone X, and the rest of the industry, now it's pretty standard to see a $1,000 smartphone. That was rather amazing to watch. And now this year, they have three new phones, and the most expensive of which is called the XS Max, is $1,100, which is pushing that price even further higher. And people seem to be paying, which is the most amazing part about it.
But not as many people. And that's the calculation they're making. It may not be as many people, but they're paying a lot more.
Well, we thought that, but here's the interesting data point. We don't know how many iPhone 10s sold versus iPhone 8s or iPhone 7s. So Apple doesn't release that data. But the one thing we have learned is that Apple says that the iPhone 10 for the last year since it came out has been its top selling phone every quarter, which means that it's not just people buying more of it, people paying more money for it. There, it seems to be that a lot of people are buying it too, which is something that most of the analysts and the experts out there didn't expect. They thought what you were going to say, which is that, you know, Apple will make a lot of money, but not a lot of people are going to buy it. It turns out that a lot of people were willing to shell out that extra money.
Are people willing to shell out the extra money every year or every 2 years?
Statistically, no. Statistically, most people are replacing their phones every 2 or 3 years, or when their contract is up, if they still have contracts, or when their phone dies, really. But there are those people like myself who tend to upgrade every year. I do it because I have a 2-year-old and I want the best camera that I can have, and I'm willing to spend that money for it. But everybody's different, right? And so what's interesting to me is that as the rest of the market has pretty much flattened out, right, there isn't much growth left in the phone market, and especially in the Western world, Apple has been able to start becoming bigger and bigger company. And that's part of why they just became a $1 trillion value on Wall Street over the summer, is that people see them actually growing in a market that is pretty stagnant.
The most expensive new phone that they're bringing out is $1,500, and that's compared to the least expensive of the trio, $750. What's the big difference between those two phones?
Sure. So the $750 version, which is called the 10R, and by the way, that's only coming out in October, so you might have to wait if you want to wait for it.
Right.
It actually has all of the same guts of the most expensive one. It has the same chips inside. It has the same even camera on the back. The big difference is that the screen quality isn't as good. So if you're watching a lot of videos on your screen, and then you might care about that. But the other thing about it is that it comes in a variety of colors. So Apple really wanted to, you know, the R I tend to call the rainbow edition, right? It has it has a blue version, a red version, a yellow version. And, that is something that Apple's kind of marketing to the more affordable world. Versus the Max, which is the bigger version, has a bigger screen. It's the best quality screen. It has it has more camera capability and stuff like that. So the differences aren't that big. But the same thing happened last year. The iPhone 8 had pretty much the same guts in it as the iPhone 10, yet the iPhone 10 sold more. So Apple's making this bet that the people who can't afford the more expensive phone will still want the cheaper one, but those who can't afford it are going to go for the more expensive one anyway.
So, I mean, you got me thinking that, okay, I can't get the most expensive one, but I'll still pay more than I would have paid a couple years ago and get something really close to the most expensive one. I mean, it's an interesting strategy. Some people have suggested that Apple is slowing its own market down with higher prices, which in turn pushes consumers to upgrade at more frequent points.
But, look, I think we're trying to still figure out how far this goes, right? I think the thing that we are all watching for at CNET is when will Apple hit the wall in terms of how much people are willing to spend? I think the common belief before last year was that nobody could sell a $1,000 smartphone with a straight face.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple has gotten away with it. And in fact, the rest of the market, all of the prices across the board of the highest-end smartphones all went up 30% over the last year.
And that concerns people.
Because everyone saw it happen.
Yeah, but that's a concern, right, for everyday Joes out there.
It can be a concern, but here's what they all argue is that you're getting more capability, right? You're getting better screens, you're getting better cameras. And I'm not saying I'm defending them, but that's what they argue when they raise these prices. And, they still, like I said, some of them are still offering the lower end phones as well. Certainly Samsung and a lot of the others have a lower version that you can buy for the lower price. But what's fascinating is that Apple, in their view, they're giving us choice. And people are choosing on the higher end, at least enough of them that Apple isn't hurting as a result of it, right? They're not getting the signals back from their customers that this is okay. They actually are getting signals that they want more.
Apple batteries have been a disappointment Do the new models address that issue?
For the most part, no. The battery life has pretty much stayed the same, which is disappointing. You know, the bigger version, the 10S Max, is actually only has about 30 minutes battery life more. And here's the interesting part. The one with the lower quality screen, the 10R, which is coming out in October, it actually has better battery life than the better versions of them. So, you know, part of this is a result of screen technology. Mm-hmm. It's a bunch of other things. But battery life, for the most part, and I've written about this on CNET before, we're not going to get significantly better battery life for the foreseeable future. Part of it is just because of technology of batteries. It's just not getting better, and it hasn't for many years. Yeah. And there isn't anything on the horizon to make it better, which is sad.
There's no breakthrough, in other words.
No, there really aren't any major breakthroughs. The best that we can hope for, that when I've spoken to the experts who work on batteries every day, is that they tell me that the best they're going to be able to squeeze out in the next 10 or 15 years is maybe doubling the battery life we have, which means you'll get to 2 days maybe instead of one. But that's it. And that's only coming in the future. It's not today for anybody, any technology.
How much do they invest in battery technology? I mean, is this a big deal? That would be probably the next big breakthrough, I would imagine. Because I guess, how much can they keep pushing the capabilities of the phone without improving battery life?
That is a fascinating question. So to your first question, they are spending a lot of money on it because whoever breaks through first is going to win big time, right? Because everyone, the top complaint on any satisfaction survey is battery life for every phone out there. So that is a big thing. But the other thing is that the way that they're able to squeeze out battery life improvements these days is by making their chips more efficient and writing better software. That is the thing that has pushed Apple for many years, is that they have been able to really make the, you know, that they own their own chips when they make their iPhones, which mm-hmm. no other company does. So they're able to design their chips specifically for what they want them to do, which gives them better battery life. And they're very good at making sure their software is power efficient. Other companies are also getting on this trend, which you see every year. Some of them are getting better and better. But there's a reason that most of our studies and most of our when we're doing reviews, we find that Apple tends to be at least at the same rate as everybody else. It's because this is just a battery problem. It's no longer a technology problem.
The two-camera feature, it's only available on the most expensive devices, right?
So it's only available on the iPhone X, which is $1,000, and the XS Max, which starts at $1,100. The XR, that rainbow version that I mentioned that's coming out in October, will only have one of the cameras. And that's pretty standard camera, the one that's kind of a normal wide-angle lens. It doesn't zoom in. But Apple has done things to make it so that you feel like you have the second camera. So the second camera primarily is a zoom, and it also allows you to take those beautiful portrait photos you may have seen all over the place. And we have a couple of them on scene if you want to look at them. But what's interesting is the XR is able to take those photos with a single camera. And what they're doing is they use, again, very advanced software to be able to create that effect of the blurred background. They say it's very good. We haven't tested it yet. But if they're able to pull it off, it's going to be a pretty big coup, because a lot of people, I think, who want those better cameras tend to do it because they want to be able to take those beautiful photos.
And by the way, I mean, there was another issue about earbuds, right? Or whether you
have,
yeah. Before I let you go, I wanted you to talk about that, because that was another thing
Absolutely.
That they didn't address.
Yeah, so that's it. Look, the whole industry has started removing the headphone jack from their phones, right? The headphone jack, which has been around for decades, you know, Apple and a bunch of other companies say it's time to remove them. We need them to create more space for the battery. And Apple did that. And then what they did is that they sold the phones along with this little adapter, which would plug into the bottom of the phone for the power port and allow you to plug in a normal headphone jack headphone. Well, this year they removed that. You have to pay $10 for it now, which I think any reasonable person would say, come on, I spent $1,000 and you're not going to give me a $9.
Can you throw it in? Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's really, it feels stingy. And this is one of those things about Apple that when I've been covering them for years, is that every once in a while something like this happens where it'll make you feel like you're being nickeled and dimed after spending $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done this before, and people respond poorly. And Apple probably isn't going to change its mind about it, but it's frustrating to watch them happen.
Because people keep buying.
Yeah, of course, people keep buying. And also, look, Apple has data we don't. And one of the things I'm curious about is, what was the calculus in looking like they're a stingy company that made them say it's worth doing. And my theory is that enough people are buying wireless headphones these days that they think it doesn't matter. And that would be a fascinating data point if it were true. Yeah. I don't know for sure. I've gone wireless myself, which was a big change for me. I thought I would never do the wireless thing. And now I use them every day. So it might be that people are starting to do it more and more. We'll see as time goes on.
I haven't, but my husband has. So, yeah,
see?
I mean, yeah, it's but you know what? It was a deal that Apple threw in when our kid got a tablet, or not a tablet, but a computer.
Right. That was the other thing, is that every once in a while, Apple finds ways to convince you to do these upgrades
and then
by making it enticing.
And then speaking of that, our son got it through OSU, through the deal at OSU. Apple is working really hard to work with universities and schools, right, to create these deals.
Well, they used to be the de facto school thing, right? I mean, back when computers were still getting started, Apple was considered the education leader, and then they lost it. And they have worked really hard. You know, they worked last year. They released a version of the iPad that's cheaper, specifically for schools and for students. Mm-hmm. They've created accessories designed for schools and software. They are really trying to take over that market again. And look, I will tell you, I have a two-year-old, so I don't have a kid in school yet. But my nephews who are in school, they are using Google Chromebooks and Apple iPads. Those are the two devices they use. And that is so different from what it used to be. So that is a big thing that Apple sees an opportunity with.
Ian Scherer, thanks for joining us again. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Take care.
Ian Scherer, executive editor at CNET. We'll have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. School safety returned to the spotlight in February after the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Whenever there's a shooting like that, school officials across the country ask themselves and each other, what could we do better to protect our students? Some Ohio schools and others across the country are turning to social media monitoring companies that can scan the ether and alert school officials when a threat is perceived. Vermont-based Social Sentinel is one such company. Joining us by phone, Social Sentinel CEO Gary Margolis. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Glad to be here.
Also joining us by phone, Lebanon City School Superintendent Todd Yowie. Welcome to the show.
Ann, thanks for having me.
Todd Yowie, your district uses the service, so what was the calculation there?
Well, we really, as a school district, are looking for any means that we can prevent some type of active shooting or violent school altercations. And as those have happened across the country, I think more and more investigation has revealed that there are oftentimes many red flags that can help predict whether a student is going to act out in some way. And anything we can do as school officials to monitor that and address it when it appears to be a true threat is just one more tool that we have to keep kids safe.
What kind of alerts have you received so far?
We have received public social media posts that, use a variety of words that could be used in a threatening manner that alert us to public social media posts in our geographic region that might pertain to either our schools or our students. And we have been able to investigate those. Fortunately for us, we have not had a threat that turned out to be credible, but we've had several that we've investigated and then discovered that it was not a credible threat. But in the past, we would not have had the opportunity to investigate unless a student or a parent reported something that they saw on social media. And so, you know, I don't think it's really about how many threats we receive or how many threats we investigate. You know, if we just get one or two a year that actually provides us information on something that was a real threat, it's really worth the program.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about how some Ohio school districts and others across the country are turning to social media monitoring companies that scan and alert school officials when a threat is perceived online. You just heard from Todd Yowie. He's superintendent of Lebanon City Schools, where they use this service. Also with us, Gary Margolis. He's CEO of Social Sentinel, one of those companies. And Gary Margolis, you call your company a content-driven social media public safety model. What does that mean?
Well, first of all, as you know, a parent of two teenagers and grateful for leaders like Superintendent Yowie who are looking for that multi-layered strategy to pay attention to that social like safety net for their schools, we knew that when the need arose, when the desire to understand the conversation that had gone digital, how do we do that? How do we do it and respect privacy and respect the rights of our students and to not be monitored and followed? Mm-hmm. We wanted to create a solution which looked at the content, not at the individuals. And so that's what we do. We scan billions of social media posts against information in our library of harm, we call it, cultivated by experts in school safety and security and counseling and mental health and school leadership and administration, to look for those signals of harm, those needles in the digital haystack. And, you know, today the conversations happening with our students are happening online, with our communities, not even just students, but, you know, we are living in an online world. And without a service like ours, folks like the superintendent who are responsible for a safe learning environment are often at a disadvantage because they don't have insights into what might be happening.
How do you scan content without, knowing who's putting it out there?
Well, we look at, again, the content, and if we identify a signal, we have hundreds of thousands of threat indicators that we've cultivated from research and linguistics and data science. If we identify a signal, we identify a potential threat, and we deliver an alert, folks like the superintendent who received that information are then able to look and say, well, who is this person that this is attached to? Let's go see. Just yesterday, I had a phone call. I had a conversation with a superintendent who had received some information that came from our system. And as he and I were talking, he called me. He said, I got to tell you that this was very helpful. It turns out that superintendent actually lifts weights 3 times a week with that student and didn't realize the student was crying out for help and was doing it through social media. And without our ability to look and find that signal and then deliver that information, he would have been at a disadvantage in knowing what was going on in this student's life.
And this isn't just about identifying people who may do harm to others. It's also a way of identifying people who may do harm to themselves.
Well, it's outcries. It's crying for help. And whether it's someone who's threatening to harm someone else or the school or an event or talking about how they're feeling about themselves, mm-hmm. To someone, again, in the superintendent's position who cares about the social and emotional wellness of all of the people in their district, in their community, and in their students, it's another piece of that insight to be able to reach out and provide some help and to lend a helping hand. Because there's connections between, you know, wanting to not feeling good, to hurting ourselves, to hurting others. It's just that outcry for help.
Todd Yowie, obviously you're making public that you're using this service, and it's a public expenditure, so public school districts have to reveal if they're asked, but other districts have not made a point of going public with it. What were your thoughts about that?
Well, we're not publicizing it per se or marketing that the district has it, but at the same time, we're not keeping it a secret. As we conduct investigations and so on, you know, students, parents ask, how did you get this information? And we think it's important for our community to know that we're doing as much as we can to look after our students and prohibit acts of violence. And one of those, you know, one of many ways that we do that is through the monitoring of social media.
What about free speech issues, Gary Margolis, that someone's just expressing themselves on social media? Why should they maybe eventually or potentially be penalized for that?
First of all, we, like every good citizen of this country, support our rights to free speech. And, you know, we did not build a surveillance or a monitoring tool. We built a scanning tool looking for these signals of harm. And when it's shared publicly on social media, that expectation of I think privacy, I think, changes, that public outcry, that public statement. And so, again, it's about being there to lend that helping hand, to reach out to support the person who may be, you know, sharing something that's of concern.
How much does it cost your school district, Todd Yowie?
We currently are paying half of the cost because here in Warren County, our county ESC is picking up half of the cost as well. And it's less than a dollar a student. I believe it's 60 cents a student.
And how many students do you have?
We have 5,700 students.
How do you price this, Gary Margolis?
Just like the superintendent explained, pricing is a per student model. That's a fairly consistent technology model for schools and how they calculate costs for services like ours.
And do people have to agree to participate? I mean, if you tell them we're investigating this, Todd Yowie, do they have to agree with the investigation? Do they have to participate?
All our investigations are turned over to law enforcement, and so it's a law enforcement investigation, so people have to cooperate to the extent that they would have to cooperate with any law enforcement investigation.
Have you gotten any pushback?
We have not received any pushback. In fact, I would say we've had the opposite of pushback. We've had many parents and community members express thank you for doing all that we can to protect our students, and they understand that, you know, the technology is available to monitor public posts and that we're taking advantage of that technology as part of our safety and security planning here in Lebanon.
Gary Margolis, is there concern? I've read there's concern about a slippery slope, that right now you have these parameters, you stick to them, and I'm not talking about you particularly or your company, but that the industry may start sliding into something more insidious.
Well, you know, I can speak to what we do and our commitment to being a part of a layered security strategy for districts like the superintendent's and for teams like his. You know, three things have to happen for us to, you know, generate an alert. We have to be able to access all that information, that about a billion a day. We have to trigger something in our library, and we have to make an association with a client, and in this case, the district and the school district. So this is not a wide-open search tool. It's very narrow in the sense of it's looking for those indications of harm. It's like a smoke detector or a carbon monoxide detector. And the vast majority of alerts that are generated when they arrive don't necessarily result in a police investigation. They may be a school inquiry, and that inquiry might be, again, based on support and help, not on investigation and punishment. You know, so much of the information that our system identifies is that general harm. Some of that might include particular targeted acts of violence, that does happen, but it also may include, again, those outcries that give folks like the superintendent a bit of insight into that social emotional wellness needs of their students.
Are the alerts automatic, or is there human intervention in there anywhere?
They are automatic. Our technology, we've pioneered identifying the language of harm on social media and open source platforms. And so that's what we've been able to do. We've taken out that that part of the human component, and really taught our algorithms and our machine learning to our computers. Again, based on working with experts in social media linguistics, data science, harm counseling, school safety and security, etc.
And when you refer to the language of harm, how many words are in that? In that language?
Well, it goes far beyond words. We have we call it our library. It has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of behavioral threat indicators. We have studied unfortunate, tragic events that have happened. We have looked at very public outcries. We have again met with folks who are experts in linguistics and data science and brought them into the team. One of our data scientists is a proud graduate of The Ohio State University, so I needed to make sure I made a call up for that. He's excited about me being on your program. So we've put a lot of effort into decoding what that language looks like, again, because leaders like the superintendent, and given my own experience in being a part of a school safety team, we're trying to understand how do our communities talk online and not talk about all the positive things in our lives, which is vastly what social media does, but how do we talk about the things that can be disturbing and can be that outcry for help? And we wanted to be the ones to decode what that looked like so that our service could be of value to the superintendent and schools across the country.
Gary Margolis, CEO of Social Sentinel, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Social Sentinel is one of those companies. It's a social media monitoring company that scans online platforms and alerts school officials when a threat is perceived. Todd Yowie, superintendent of Lebanon City Schools, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ann.
Todd Yowie, superintendent of Lebanon City Schools, again, where they are employing the services of Social Sentinel. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. You can buy a computer for $280 now. The catch is you have to build it and code some software. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly joins us by phone to talk about that and more tech news. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's called a computer, but you first have to build it, and you also have to do some coding. How does all that work?
Well, this is actually a continuation of an effort from a company called Kano. They've been working on kid-friendly computers for a while that teach more than just how to open a web browser and go to Facebook or watch a video on YouTube. This is kind of taking back to the core foundations of how a computer works. So it starts off with a very simple Raspberry Pi and some cables that shows the kids how each one of the parts work, why you're connecting a cable to a different part of the computer for how the display works and how you're connecting a keyboard and things like that, just kind of very simple parts that are all coming together. And then when you turn everything on, the operating system is built like a video game, where it walks you through this video game world where you travel from the CPU to the RAM to the storage to the network connection. As though it were this island that you have to walk through and kind of explore to understand how all of these parts work. And throughout the process of that, you're given these kind of simple programming challenges to kind of bring these parts of the island up and functional.
We have talked about this before. You really are enthusiastic about it. You think it's great for kids particularly to know what they're doing and not be sort of these hapless pawns of the computer industry. And I think
it's super important for everyone to understand just a little bit about how computers work. But yeah, building this into the way kids are using computers, I think is super important.
So we've talked about it before. What's different now?
This new version is actually is a touch laptop. It's almost a tablet, and you still get a mouse and keyboard that come with the box. But the screen itself is a touch screen, and there's new software built in to take advantage of the touch interface. So teaching the child, you know, how the touch interface works, it actually goes through and shows, you know, how the touch system on the screen works with all of these tiny sensors that are underneath the glass, and walks the child through the, you know, the different ways to use touch to accomplish a lot of the same tasks. And then, you know, gives them simple programming exercises like, you know, drawing your finger across the screen. But as you draw the finger across the screen, the longer you've held your finger on the screen, the line that you're drawing can change colors. And so it gives them, you know, kind of control over what colors show up for how long they have the finger on the screen and things like that. Really simple, basic programming exercises that give them the flexibility to, you know, be creative at the same time as learning this, you know, kind of basic programming process.
You know, and for all of that, you know, $280, you know, do you think it's a fair bargain?
I think it's a really fair bargain. I think once you get past kind of the gaming part of this, you get this full desktop environment. It's a Linux desktop environment, but it's still a desktop environment with a browser and access to YouTube and email services and things like that. So this is a system that is designed to kind of grow up with the kids for a couple of years. And it's just a, you know, it's a great educational resource, but it's also super functional, which I really appreciate.
And how old do they have to be? What do you think?
I think you could start, you know, easily with, you know, age 4 or 5, really just kind of basic, you know, once they're comfortable reading, you know, this is a good place to start. And then, you know, as they age up, you can, as the parent, kind of enable other features and access points and give them, you know, kind of basic feedback on how to use things before you ever even give them access to the internet. You know, this is really just, you know, kind of basic computer usage. And then once you do give them access to the internet, you have a lot of control there as well.
How is it in the durability department, given that this is largely geared toward children?
It's super durable. This is actually really cool because it's all of the outer pieces are this big kind of bulky, rigid plastic. But the core computer parts underneath are a Raspberry Pi and a display board that you connect to that are both not only difficult to break inside of these cases, but super easy to replace if something does happen, and fairly inexpensive to replace if something does happen. So it's not kind of a world-ending thing if it gets dropped every once in a while. There is a little more fragility with this new version because you are using a touchscreen, and touchscreens tend to be a little more fragile than you know, kind of normal displays. So, you know, carrying it around like a tablet may not be great for younger kids, but it's so big, you know, it's a thick, you know, kind of wedge shape that encourages everyone really to kind of grab it with two hands and walk around. So it's in my opinion a lot more easy for a younger kid to use than an iPad.
You know, your kids are getting older now. Who do you test this stuff on?
Torin, my son, he is 8 and still absolutely loves this entire process. He loves the programming challenges that come into it. He has a much greater understanding now of how the different islands in the game work, and so can kind of talk about that. But also, you know, enjoys that when he's done with that, he can go and watch something on YouTube.
And is it something that a kid and a parent would work on together, or do you think a kid could be pretty independent with this project?
I think that a kid could be pretty independent with a project like this, but it would really depend on the parent and how comfortable the parent is with a lot of the tech. It's kind of a difficult question for me to answer because a lot of this stuff is kind of natural to me, but... I would think that it would be something that largely a child could handle on their own. And the instructions are pretty simple to read if the child gets stuck and the parent needs to help.
That, moving from that to the world of house cleaning, Dyson just made a big announcement in the vacuum world. The new 360 Heurist can see in the dark. Okay, why? Why, Russell?
Why is it important for a vacuum to be able to see?
Yes.
So that the vacuum can do its thing while you're not around.
So this is one of those little robot vacuums.
This is, well, we call it little. It's actually kind of funny. A lot of the robot vacuums we see are pretty small. They don't usually come up as far as an ankle. There's just not a whole lot to these most of the time. But the Dyson line of robot vacuums are actually kind of huge. They're, you know, because of the Dyson kind of vacuum technology being the big kind of cylinder that it is, these are kind of tall. They don't slide under chairs quite as easily as some of the other systems that we've seen. And this one is very much the same. So it's a little taller, but it's, you know, it's the same kind of cylinder that moves around and cleans things up. And yeah, it has new sensors on it that allow it to see obstacles in front of it in the dark. The whole idea there being that you can let it run at night while you're not, you know, doing anything in that room.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess I always thought that these vacuums could do this at night. I wasn't thinking about them having to see something.
It all depends on obstacle detection, right? So, I mean, like these can, if you know that there's not stuff on your floor, if you know that you don't have a, you know, 8 or 9 year old who leaves toys everywhere, then it's not a big deal to have this thing run every night, because you know that the stuff that's on the ground is kind of small and it'll get vacuumed up and it'll be fine. But in the case of, you know, cables being left on the ground or toys,
Legos,
or
toys,
like that,
yeah.
You know, I have woken up several mornings, you know, with some robot vacuum that I was testing or another that has, you know, had to stop mid journey because it vacuumed up half a bunny rabbit and it just kind of stopped in the floor and didn't really know what to do next. There's a lot of software that gets built into some of these newer things that are built for obstacle detection. So it sees that thing and instead of running over it, it just knows to move around it.
It's a stuffed bunny rabbit, by the way, right? Like a bunny rabbit toy.
Yeah.
Okay, just checking.
Call it that.
All right. And are there other technology? I mean, you're pretty experienced with these robot vacuums, then. It sounds like you've done your share of testing.
Yeah, so these have been around for a little while. The robot vacuums, they're pretty cool. They're not super great if you have pets who really, you know, want to know what's going on with this tiny cylinder that's mm-hmm. moving around on its own. You know, and a lot of it, again, comes to obstacle detection. You know, if the vacuum knows that there's something in front of it that it needs to avoid, then that is a much better thing than it just kind of running over, you know, anything that's in front of it. And so that's a big part of what makes these more successful moving forward, is being able to do that. And then also being able to do it quietly enough that it can run without, you know, disrupting something else happening in another room.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, too, is if it runs at night, what's the sound like?
So we haven't actually tested this one yet, so I'm not sure. The previous version, the previous version of the 360i was a little on the noisy side. And again, this is built on Dyson's technology. Dyson's vacuums have this kind of reputation for being very good, but also kind of loud. So the first version of this was, you know, followed in those footsteps, and this is, you know, supposed to address that a little bit. So we'll see how that works out.
You know, we talk a lot about phones and watches and all the, how much they cost and that kind of thing. But when you think about it, a vacuum cleaner, they can be very expensive now.
Vacuum cleaners can be very expensive. And the, you know, the Roomba series has been kind of the popular robot vacuum of choice. And it has been slowly coming down in price, you know, so that it, you know, it starts at around $300, but can work itself up to, you know, closer to $600, depending on which model you get. The Dyson vacuums are often pretty expensive because they come with a reputation and a guarantee and things like that. And this kind of smart vacuum is more expensive than most of those, you know, stand-up Dyson vacuums. This starts at about $1,000. And the whole idea is that, you know, it's a Dyson that you don't ever have to touch.
It's going to be available in China first.
Right. This is going to be available in China first, and then we'll get a U.S. release date probably in the spring.
Hmm. Are they made in China?
I don't actually know. I think they probably are, but I'm
wondering
about
the tariffs and things like that.
Yeah, tariffs may end up being a thing there, and then also a lot of the sensors that get used in this are brand new sensors that we don't really see used in much anything else. You know, not. It's almost like they've got little headlights on them. To see everything that's in front of it. And that's kind of a new thing for this category of device. So there may be extra rules there for entering the U.S.
Let's turn to gaming. Xbox announced new games. Final Fantasy is a popular game series. It never made its way to Xbox One, though. That's one of the new games, right?
This is actually a whole suite of Final Fantasy games. Mm-hmm. There are a ton of them that have been released over the last, you know, 25 years. And several of the more popular Final Fantasy games that were originally either on Nintendo or on PlayStation, they're actually coming to both the Xbox One and Nintendo Switch later this year. And this is kind of a big deal. It's not something that the game producer, you know, Square Enix has ever done to any kind of great effect is port, you know, games to multiple consoles at the same time. They usually have a kind of exclusive period with one manufacturer or one developer, and then they kind of branch out from there. And this is a new way of making these games available to more people.
Why do you think?
Or if you're someone like buying them for the third or fourth time.
So why do you think they're doing that? Why the departure?
I think that these are tremendously popular games that people in particular around my age have grown up with. You know, Final Fantasy VII is one of the most popular games that was ever made for my generation, and so making them available in more places just makes a lot of financial sense. They can charge, $20 for a game that came out, almost 20 years ago. And, have that game, still make quite a bit of money, but also, mess with the graphics so that it looks good on high definition televisions and be able to kind of share that experience with people who never actually sat down to play those games.
What makes Final Fantasy such a popular game, do you think?
I think a lot of it was, kind of a new thing at the time where it was this deep, long form game that you could play for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it had a long, engaging story with characters that were kind of fun. And it was just kind of a new thing at the time. And people really kind of, grasped onto it and never let it go. It spawned an entire genre of games that became very popular around that time. And still, we still run into role play games that are very similar to the Final Fantasy series, across all mediums, including phone games that bear a lot of similarities to Final Fantasy games.
When you decide you're going to spend some time playing a game, do you actually sit around and think, okay, what do I feel like playing today?
No, I usually have like one game in mind, that I'm going to block out a Saturday or something to play that game. I don't usually have like a library that I choose from.
Okay.
But I do know people who, they have to be in a certain mood to play a certain game. And so they're playing, a couple different things depending on what mood they're in.
Yeah, I would think that would be more like what I would be like if I were to do that. Little bits. You want to talk about three new inventor kits. We don't have a lot of time, but I wanted to get to these. What's in them?
Yeah, so these inventor kits are designed for kids to be able to quickly assemble, basic projects. Little robots that can move things from one place to another, or a little electric guitar that you can make yourself, or something that looks like the Mars rover. These are really simple kits that include snap together circuits that you can, quickly assemble and then program instructions for it to do whatever. And each one of these kits they're going to be about $100, and they come out, and I think in 2 weeks.
Are they going to be on your holiday gift list show when we do that in November?
At least one of them will. I think probably the music kit, just because it's really cool to be able to build your own little cardboard electric guitar and have it actually do stuff when you move your fingers. That's kind of neat.
Okay. All right. Well, Russell Holly, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time as always.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. I want to just remind you to like All Sides on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter too at Ann Fisher, WOSU. That's it for Tech Tuesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.